behind the barbarian.
Lord Brandenburg,
Feringel cried. Lady Priscilla shouted at her brother. Do it now before they ruin every—
The child is mine, Wolfgar declared.
Priscilla bit off the end of her sentence in surprise. Feringel froze as if turned to stone.
What?
The young lord gasped.
What?
Lady Priscilla gasped.
What?
Gasped Morric at the same time.
What?
Gasped Miralda quietly, and she coughed quickly to cover her surprise.
The child is mine,
Wolfgar repeated firmly.
And if you throw her out the window, then you shall follow so quickly that you'll pass her by and your broken body will pad her fall.
You are so eloquent in emergencies, Morric remarked. To Lord Feringel he added, The window is small, yes, but I'll wager that my big friend can squeeze you through it, and your plump sister as well.
You can't be the father,
Lord Feringel declared, trembling so violently that it seemed as if his legs would just buckle beneath him. He looked to Priscilla for an answer, to his sister, who was always hovering above him with all of the answers.
What trick is this?
Give it to me,
Priscilla demanded. Taking advantage of her brother's paralyzing confusion, she moved quickly and tore the child from Feringel's grasp. Miralda cried out, the baby cried, and Wolfgar started forward, knowing that he could never get there in time, knowing that the innocent was surely doomed. Even as Priscilla turned for the window, her brother leaped before her and slugged her in the face. Stunned, she staggered back a step. Feringel snatched the child from her arms and shoved her again, sending his sister stumbling to the floor. Wolfgar eyed the man for a long and telling moment, understanding then, beyond any doubt, that despite his obvious anger and revulsion, Feringel would not hurt the child. The barbarian strode across the room, secure in his observations, confident that the young man would take no action against the babe.
The child is mine,
the barbarian said with a growl, reaching over to gently pull the wailing baby from Feringel's weakening grasp.
I meant to wait another month before returning, he explained, turning to face Miralda. But it's good you delivered early. A child of mine come to full term would likely have killed you in birthing.
Wolfgar!
Morric cried suddenly. Lord Feringel, apparently recovering some of his nerve and most of his rage, produced a dagger from his belt and came in hard at the barbarian. Morric needn't have worried, though, for Wolfgar heard the movement. Lifting the babe high with one arm to keep her from harm's way, he spun and slapped the dagger aside with his free hand. As Feringel came in close, Wolfgar brought his knee up hard into the man's groin. Down Lord Feringel went, curling into a mewling heap on the floor. I think my large friend can make it so that you never have children of your own, Morric remarked with a wink to Miralda. Miralda didn't even hear the words, staring dumbfounded at Wolfgar, at the child he had proclaimed as his own.
For my actions on the road, I truly apologize, Lady Miralda, the barbarian said,
and he was playing to a full audience now as Liam Woodgate, Steward Temegast, and the remaining half-dozen castle guards appeared at the door, staring in wide-eyed disbelief. On the floor before Wolfgar, Lady Priscilla looked up at him, confusion and unbridled anger simmering in her eyes.
It was the bottle and your beauty that took me, Wolfgar explained.
He turned his attention to the child, his smile wide as he lifted the infant girl into the air for his sparkling blue eyes to behold.
But I'll not apologize for the result of that crime, he said. Never that.
I will kill you,
Lord Feringel growled, struggling to his knees. Wolfgar reached down with one hand and grabbed him by the collar. Helping him up with a powerful jerk, he spun the lord around into a chokehold.
You will forget me and the child,
Wolfgar whispered into his ear.
Else the combined tribes of Icewind Dale will sack you in your wretched little village.
Wolfgar pushed the young lord, spinning him into Morric's waiting grasp. Staring at Liam and the other dangerous guards, the rogue wasted no time in putting a sharp dagger to the man's throat.
Secure us supplies for the road, Wolfgar instructed. We need wrappings and food for the babe.
Everyone in the room, save Wolfgar and the baby, wore incredulous expressions.
Do it! The barbarian roared.
Frowning, Morik pushed toward the door with Lord Feringal, waving a scrambling Priscilla out ahead of him. Fetch! The rogue instructed Liam and Priscilla. He glanced back and saw Wolfgar moving toward Meralda then, so he pushed out even further, backing them all away.
What made you do such a thing?
Meralda asked when she was alone with Wolfgar and the child.
Your problem was not hard to discern, Wolfgar explained.
I falsely accused you.
Understandably so, Wolfgar replied. You were trapped and scared, but in the end you risked everything to free me from prison. I could not let that deed go unpaid.
Meralda shook her head,
too overwhelmed to even begin to sort this out.
So many thoughts and emotions whirled in her mind. She had seen the look of despair on Feringal's face, had thought he would, indeed, drop the baby to the rocks. Yet in the end he hadn't been able to do it, hadn't let his sister do it. She did love this man, how could she not? And yet, she could hardly deny her unexpected feelings for her child, though she knew that never, ever could she keep her.
I am taking the babe far from here, Wolfgar said determinedly, as if he had read her mind. You are welcome to come with us.
Meralda laughed softly, without humor, because she knew she would be crying soon enough.
I can't,
she explained, her voice a whisper.
I've a duty to my husband, if he'll still have me, and to my family. My folks would be branded if I went with you.
Duty? Is that the only reason you're staying? Wolfgar asked her,
apparently sensing something more.
I love him, you know,
Meralda replied, tears streaming down her beautiful face.
I know what you must think of me, but truly the babe was made before I ever...
Wolfgar held up his hand.
You owe me no explanation, he said, for I am hardly in a position to judge you or anyone else. I came to understand your problem, and so I returned to repay your generosity, that is all.
He looked to the door through which Morik held Lord Feringal.
He does love you, he said. His eyes and the depth of his pain showed that clearly.
You think I'm right in staying?
Wolfgar shrugged, again refusing to offer any judgments.
I can't leave him,
Meralda said, and she reached up and tenderly stroked the child's face.
But I cannot keep her either. Feringal would never accept her,
she admitted, her tone empty and hollow, for she realized that her time with her daughter was nearing its end.
Perhaps he'd give her over to another family in Orkney now that he's thinking I didn't betray him,
she suggested faintly.
A reminder to him of his pain, and to you of your lie,
Wolfgar said softly, not accusing the woman, but surely reminding her of the truth.
And within the reach of his shrewish sister.
Meralda lowered her gaze and accepted the bitter truth.
The baby was not safe in Orkney.
Who better to raise her than me?
Wolfgar asked suddenly, resolve in his voice. He looked down at the little girl, and his mouth turned up into a warm smile.
You do that?
Wolfgar nodded.
Happily.
You'd keep her safe?
Meralda pressed.
Tell her of her ma?
Wolfgar nodded.
I don't know where my road now leads, he explained. But I suspect I'll not venture too far from here. Perhaps someday I will return, or at least she will, to glimpse her ma.
Meralda was shaking with sobs, her face gleaming with tears. Wulfgar glanced to the doorway to make sure that he was not being watched, then bent down and kissed her on the cheek.
"I think it best," he said quietly. "Do you agree?"
After she studied the man for a moment, this man who had risked everything to save her and her child, though they had done nothing to deserve his heroism. Miralda nodded. The tears continued to flow freely. Wulfgar could appreciate the pain she was feeling, the depth of her sacrifice. He leaned in, allowing Miralda to stroke and kiss her baby girl one last time. But when she moved to take her away, Wulfgar pulled back. Miralda's smile of understanding was bittersweet.
"Farewell, little one,"
she said through her sobs and looked away. Wulfgar bowed to Miralda one last time, then, with the baby cradled in his big arms, he turned and left the room. He found Morik in the hallway, barking commands for plenty of food and clothing, and gold, for they'd need gold to properly situate the child in warm and comfortable inns. Barbarian, baby, and thief made their way through the castle, and no one made a move to stop them. It seemed as if Lord Feringhal had cleared their path, wanting the two thieves and the bastard child out of his castle and out of his life as swiftly as possible. Priscilla, however, was a different issue. They ran into her on the first floor, where she came up to Wulfgar and tried to take the baby, glaring at him defiantly all the while. The barbarian held her at bay, his expression making it clear that he would break her in half if she tried to harm the child. Priscilla huffed her disgust, threw a thick wool wrap at him, and with a final growl of protest, turned on her heel. "Stupid cow," Morik muttered under his breath. Chuckling, Wulfgar tenderly wrapped the baby in the warm blanket, finally silencing her crying. Outside, the daylight was fast on the wane, but the storm had faded, the last clouds breaking apart and rushing across the sky on swift winds. The gate was lowered. Across the bridge they saw Steward Temegast waiting for them with a pair of horses, Lord Feringhal at his side. Feringhal stood staring at Wulfgar and the baby for a long moment. "If you ever come back," he started to say.
"Why would I?" the barbarian interrupted. "I have my child now, and she will grow up to be a queen in Icewind Dale. Entertain no thoughts of coming after me, Lord Feringhal, to the ruin of all your world."
"Why would I?"
Feringhal returned in the same grim tone, facing up to Wulfgar boldly.
"I have my wife, my beautiful wife, my innocent wife, who gives herself to me willingly. I do not have to force myself upon her."
That last statement, a recapture of some measure of manly pride, told Wulfgar that Feringhal had forgiven Miralda, or that he soon enough would. Wulfgar's desperate, unconsidered, and purely improvised plan had somehow miraculously worked. He bit back any semblance of a chuckle at the ridiculousness of it all, let Feringhal have his needed moment. He didn't even blink as the Lord of Orkney composed himself, squared his shoulders, and walked back across the bridge through the lowered gate to his home and his wife. Steward Temegast handed the reins to the pair.
"She isn't yours," the steward said unexpectedly.
Starting to pull himself and the babe up into the saddle, Wulfgar pretended not to hear him.
"Fear not, for I'll not tell. Nor will Miralda, whose life you have truly saved this day," the steward went on. "You are a fine man, Wulfgar, son of Beornagar, of the tribe of the Elk of Icewind Dale."
Wulfgar blinked in amazement, both at the compliment and at the simple fact that the man knew so much of him. "The wizard who caught you told him," Morik reasoned. "I hate wizards."
"There will be no pursuit," said Temegast, "on my word."
And that word held true, for Morik and Wulfgar rode without incident back to the overhang, where they retrieved their own horses, then continued down the east road and out of Orkney for good.
What is it?
Wulfgar asked Morik later that night, seeing the rogue's amused expression. They were huddled around a blazing fire, keeping the child warm. Morik smiled and held up a pair of bottles, one with warm goat's milk for the child, the other with their favored potent drink. Wulfgar took the one with the goat's milk.
I will never understand you, my friend, Morik remarked.
Wulfgar smiled but did not respond.
Morik could never truly know of Wulfgar's past, of the good times with Drizzt and the others, and of the very worst times with Ertu and the offspring of his stolen seed.
There are easier ways to make gold, Morik remarked, and that brought Wulfgar's steely gaze over him.
You mean to sell the child, of course, Morik reasoned.
Wulfgar scoffed.
A fine price,
Morik argued, taking a healthy swig from the bottle.
Not fine enough, said Wulfgar, turning back to the babe.
The little girl wriggled and cooed.
You cannot plan to keep her, Morik argued. What place has she with us? With you, wherever you plan to go. Have you lost all sensibility?
Scowling, Wulfgar spun on him, slapped the bottle from his hands, then shoved him back to the ground, as determined an answer as Morik the rogue had ever heard.
She's not even yours, Morik reminded him.
The rogue could not have been more wrong. Epilogue. Morik looked at Wulfgar's disguise one more time and sighed helplessly. There was only so much one could do to change the appearance of a nearly 7-foot-tall, 300-pound, blonde-haired barbarian. Wulfgar was clean-shaven again for the first time since his return from the abyss. Morik had taught him to walk in a way that would somewhat lessen his height, with shoulders drooped but arms crooked so that they did not hang to his knees. Also, Morik had procured a large brown robe such as a priest might wear, with a bunched collar that allowed Wulfgar to scrunch down his neck without being obvious about it. Still, the rogue was not entirely happy with the disguise, not when so much was riding on it. You should wait out here, he offered, for perhaps the 10th time since Wulfgar had told him his wishes.
No, Wulfgar said evenly. They would not come at your word alone. This is something I must do.
Get us both killed, the rogue asked sarcastically.
Lead on, Wulfgar said, ignoring him.
When Morik tried to argue, the barbarian slapped a hand over the smaller man's mouth and turned him around to face the distant city gate. With one last sigh and a shake of his head, Morik led the way back into Luskin. To the great relief of both of them, for Wulfgar surely did not wish to be discovered while carrying the baby, they were not recognized, were not detained at all, but merely strode into the city where the spring festival was on in full. They had come in late in the day by design. Wulfgar went straight to Half Moon Street, arriving at the Cutlass as one of the evening's first patrons. He moved to the bar right beside Josie Puddles.
What are you drinking?
Aramgard Peck asked. But the question caught in his throat, and his eyes went wide as he looked more carefully at the big man.
Wulfgar, he gasped.
Behind the barbarian, a tray dropped, and Wulfgar turned to see Deli Curdy standing there, stunned. Josie Puddles gave a squeal and leaned away.
Well met, Aram, Wulfgar said to the tavern keeper. I drink only water. What are you doing here?
The tavern keeper gasped, suspicious and more than a little fearful. Josie hopped off his stool and started for the door, but Wulfgar caught him by the arm and held him in place.
I came to apologize, the barbarian offered. To you? And to you, he added, turning to Josie.
Ye tried to kill me,
Josie sputtered.
I was blind with anger, and likely drink, Wulfgar replied.
He took your hammer,
Aram reminded.
Out of rightful fear that I would use it against you, the barbarian answered. He acted as a friend. which is much more than I can say for Wolfkar."
Aram shook his head, hardly believing any of this. Wolfkar released Josie, but the man made no move to continue for the door, just stood there, dumbfounded.
"You took me in, gave me food, a paying job, and friendship when I needed it most," Wolfkar continued to Aram alone. "I wronged you, terribly so, and can only hope that you will find it in your heart to forgive me."
"Are ye looking to live here again?"
Aram asked. Wolfkar smiled sadly and shook his head.
"I risk my life by even entering the city," he replied. "I'll be gone within the hour. But I had to come, to apologize to you two, and mostly," he turned around, facing Delhi, "to you."
Delhi Curti blanched as Wolfkar approached, as if she didn't know how to react to the man's words, to the mere sight of him again.
"I am most humbly sorry for any pain that I ever caused you, Delhi," he said. "You were as true a friend as any man could ever have desired."
"More than a friend,"
Wolfkar quickly added, seeing her frown. Delhi eyed the bundle in his arms.
"Ye've a little one,"
the woman said, her voice thick with emotion.
"Mine by chance and not by heritage," Wolfkar replied.
He handed the little girl over to her. Delhi took her, smiling tenderly, playing with the child's fingers and bringing a smile to that innocent little face.
"I wish he might be staying again," Aram offered.
And he sounded sincere, though Josie's eyes widened in doubt at the mere mention.
"I cannot," Wolfkar replied.
Smiling at Delhi, he leaned over and took the babe back, then kissed Delhi on the forehead.
"I pray you find all the happiness you deserve, Delhi Curti," he said.
And with a look and a nod at Aram and Josie, he started for the door. Delhi, too, looked hard at Aram, so much her father. The man understood and nodded once again. She caught up to Wolfkar before he reached the exit.
"Take me with ye,"
she said, her eyes sparkling with hope, something few had seen from the woman in a long, long time. Wolfkar looked puzzled.
"I did not return to rescue you," he explained.
"Rescue?"
Delhi echoed incredulously.
"I'm not needin' your rescue, thank ye very much, but you're needin' help with a little one I can see. I'm good with tykes. Spent most of me young life raising me brothers and sisters, and I've grown more than a bit bored with me life here."
"I don't know where my road shall lead," Wolfkar argued.
"Safe enough, I'm guessing," Delhi replied. "Since ye've the little one to care for, I mean."
"Waterdeep, perhaps," said Wolfkar.
"A place I've always wanted to see,"
she said, her smile growing with every word, for it seemed obvious that Wolfkar was becoming more than a little intrigued by her offer. The barbarian looked curiously to Aram, and the tavern keeper nodded his head yet again. Even from that distance, Wolfkar could see a bit of moisture rimming the man's eyes. He gave the child back to Delhi, bade her wait there, and moved back to the bar with Aram and Josie.
"I'll not hurt her ever again," Wolfkar promised Aram.
"If ye do, I'll hunt ye down and kill ye," Josie growled.
Wolfkar and Aram looked at the man, Aram doubtfully, but Wolfkar working hard to keep his expression serious.
"I know that, Josie Puddles,"
he replied without sarcasm.
"And your wrath is something I would truly fear."
When he got past his own surprise, Josie puffed up his little chest with pride. Wolfkar and Aram exchanged stares.
"No drinking?"
Aram asked. Wolfkar shook his head.
"I needed the bottle to hide in," he answered honestly. "But I have learned it to be worse than what haunts me."
"And if you get bored with the girl?"
"I didn't come here for Delhi Curti," Wolfkar replied. "Only to apologize. I didn't think she would accept my apology so completely, but glad I am that she did. We'll find a good road to travel, and I'll protect her as best I can, from myself most of all.
See that ye do, Aram replied. I'll expect ye back.
Wulfgar shook Aram's hand, patted Josie on the shoulder, and moved to take Deli's arm, leading her out of the cutlass. Together, they walked away from a significant part of their lives. Lord Feringel and Meralda walked along the garden hand in hand, enjoying the springtime fragrance and beauty. Wulfgar's ploy had worked. Feringel and all the fiefdom believed Meralda the wronged party again, freeing her from blame and the young lord from ridicule. Truly, the woman felt pain at the loss of her child, but it, like her marriage, seemed well on the mend. She kept telling herself over and over that the babe was with a good and strong man, a better father than Jacka could ever have been. Many were the times Meralda cried for the lost child, but always she repeated her logical litany and remembered that her life, given her mistakes and station by birth, was better by far than she could ever have imagined. Her mother and father were healthy, and Tori visited her every day, bobbing happily among the flowers and proving more of a thorn to Priscilla than Meralda had ever been. Now the couple was simply enjoying the splendor of spring, the woman adjusting to her new life. Feringel snapped his fingers suddenly and pulled away. Meralda regarded him curiously. "I have forgotten something," her husband replied. Feringel motioned for her to wait, then ran back into the castle, nearly running down Priscilla, who was coming out the garden door. Of course, Priscilla didn't believe any of Wolfgar's tale. She scowled at Meralda, but the younger woman just turned away and moved to the wall, staring out over the waves. "Watching for your next lover to arrive," Priscilla muttered under her breath as she moved by. She often launched verbal jabs Meralda's way, and Meralda often just let them slide down her shoulders. Not this time, though. Meralda stepped in front of her sister-in-law, hands on her hips. "You've never felt an honest emotion in your miserable life, Priscilla Auk, which is why you're so bitter," she said. "Judge me not." Priscilla's eyes widened with shock, and she trembled, unused to being spoken to in such a forward manner. "You ask? I'm not asking you, I'm telling you," Meralda said curtly. Priscilla stood up and grimaced, then slapped Meralda across the face. Feeling the sting, Meralda slapped her back harder. "Judge me not, or I'll whisper the truth of your wretchedness into your brother's ear," Meralda warned, so calm and calculating that her words alone made Priscilla's face burn hot. "You can't doubt that I have his ear," Meralda finished. "Have you thought of what a life in the village among the peasants might be like for you?" Even as she finished, her husband bounded back out, a huge bouquet of flowers in his hand, flowers for his dear Meralda. Priscilla took one look at her fawning brother, gave a great cry, and ran into the castle. Feringel watched her go, confused. But so little did he care what Priscilla thought or felt these days that he didn't even bother to ask Meralda about it. Meralda, too, watched the wretched woman depart. Her smile was wrought from more than delight at her husband's thoughtful present. Much more. Morik said his farewells to Wulfgar and to Deli, then began at once to re-establish himself on Luskin's streets. He took a room at an inn on Half Moon Street, but spent little time there, for he was out working hard, telling the truth of his identity to those who needed to know, establishing a reputation as a completely different man, Burglar Brandeburg, to those who did not. By the end of the 10-day, many nodded in deference as he passed them on the streets. By the end of the month, the rogue no longer feared retribution from the authorities. He was home again, and soon things would be as they had been before Wulfgar had ever come to Luskin. He was leaving his room one night with just that in mind when he stepped out of his bedroom door into the inn's upper hallway. Instead, he found himself sliding through a dizzying tunnel, coming to rest in a crystalline room whose circular walls gave the appearance of one level in a tower. Dazed, Morik started to reach for his dagger, but he saw the ebon-skinned forms and changed his mind, wise enough not to resist the dark elves.
"You know me, Morik," said Camuriel O'Blodra, moving close to the man.
Morik did indeed recognize the drow as the messenger who had come to him a year before, bidding him to keep a watch over Wolfgar.
"I give you my friend, Rhaegai,"
Camuriel said politely, indicating the other dark elf in the room, one wearing a sinister expression.
"Did we not ask you to watch over the one named Wolfgar?"
Camuriel asked. Morik stuttered, not knowing what to say.
"And have you not failed us?"
Camuriel went on.
But that was a year ago,"
Morik protested. "I have heard nothing since."
"Now you are in hiding, in disguise, knowing your crime against us," said Camuriel.
"My supposed crimes are of another matter," Morik stuttered, feeling as if the very walls were tightening around him. "I hide from the Luskan authorities, not from you."
"From them you hide," said the other drow. "Help you I can."
He strode over to Morik and lifted his hands. Sheets of flame erupted from his fingertips, burning Morik's face and lighting his hair on fire. The rogue howled and fell to the floor, slapping at his singed skin.
"Now you appear different,"
Camuriel remarked, and both dark elves chuckled wickedly. They dragged him up the tower stairs into another room, where a bald-headed drow holding a great plumed purple hat sat comfortably in a chair.
"My apologies, Morik," he said. "My lieutenants are an excitable lot."
"I was with Wolfgar for months," Morik claimed, obviously on the edge of hysteria. "Circumstance forced us apart and forced him from Luskan. I can find him for you."
"No need," said the drow in the chair, holding up his hand to calm the groveling man. "I am Jarlaxle of Menzo Baranzon, and I forgive you in full."
Morik rubbed one hand over what was left of his hair, as if to say that he wished Jarlaxle had been so beneficent earlier.
"I had planned for Wolfgar to be my primary trading partner in Luskan, my representative here,"
Jarlaxle explained.
"Now with him gone, I ask you to assume the role."
Morik blinked, and his heart skipped a beat.
"We will make you wealthy and powerful beyond your dreams," the mercenary leader explained,
and Morik believed him.
"You'll not need to hide from the authorities. Indeed, many will invite you to their homes almost daily, for they will desperately want to remain in good standing with you. If there are any you wish eliminated, that too can be easily arranged."
Morik licked what was left of his lips.
"Does this sound like a position Morik the Rogue would be interested in pursuing?"
Jarlaxle asked, and Morik returned the dark elf's sly look tenfold.
"I warn you," Jarlaxle said, coming forward in his chair, his dark eyes flashing. "If you ever fail me, my friend Rhaegai will willingly alter your appearance yet again."
"And again," the wizard happily added.
"I hate wizards,"
Morik muttered under his breath. Wolfgar and Delhi looked down on Waterdeep, the City of Splendors. The most wondrous and powerful city on the Sword Coast, it was a place of great dreams and greater power.
"Where are ye thinking we'll be staying?"
the happy woman asked, gently rocking the child. Wolfgar shook his head.
"I have coins," he replied. "But I don't know how long we'll remain in Waterdeep."
"You're not thinking to make our lives here?"
The barbarian shrugged, for he hadn't given it much thought. He had come to Waterdeep with another purpose. He hoped to find Captain Dudermont and Sea Sprite in port, or hoped that they would come in soon, as they often did.
"Have you ever been to sea?"
he asked the woman, his best friend and partner now, with a wide smile. It was time for him to get Aegis Fang back. This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits.
to hear the beginning of Sea of Swords, Book 3 in The Legend of Drizzt, Paths of Darkness series, free. This has been an Audible Frontiers production of The Spine of the World. Written by R.A. Salvatore. Narrated by Victor Bavine. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 1999-2007 by TSR Inc., Wizards of the Coast Inc. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc. And now a free preview of Sea of Swords, Book 3 in The Legend of Drizzt, Paths of Darkness series.
Prologue. He worked his scimitars in smooth, sure, circular motions, bringing them through delicate and deceiving arcs. When the opportunity presented itself, he stepped ahead and slashed down at a seemingly exposed shoulder with one blade. But the elf, bald head shining in the sunlight, was faster. The elf dropped a foot back and raised a long sword in a solid parry, then came forward in a straight rush, stabbing with a dirk, then stepping ahead again to thrust with the sword. He danced in perfect harmony with the elf's fluid movements, twirling his twin scimitars defensively, each rolling down and over to ring against the thrusting sword. The elf stabbed again, mid-torso, then a third time, aiming low. Over and down went the scimitars, the classic double-block low. Then up those twin weapons came as the agile, hairless elf tried to kick through the block. The elf's kick was no more than a feint, and as the scimitars came up, the elf fell into a crouch and let fly the dagger. It sailed in before he could get the scimitars down low enough to block, before he could set his feet and dodge aside. A perfect throw for disembowelment. The devilish dagger caught him in the belly.
"It's Dudermont, to be sure," the crewman called, tone growing frantic. "He's caught sight of us again."
"Bah, but he's no way to know who we are," another reminded.
"Just put us around the reef and past the jetties," Sheila Cree instructed her pilot.
Tall and thick, with arms rock-hard from years of hard labor, and green eyes that showed resentment for those years, the red-headed woman stared angrily at the pursuit. The three-masted schooner forced a turn from what would certainly have proven to be a most profitable pillaging of a lightly armed merchant ship.
"Bring us a fog to block their watchin',"
the nasty pirate added, yelling at Bellany, Bloodkeel's resident sorceress.
"A fog?"
the sorceress huffed, shaking her head so that her raven-black hair bounced all about her shoulders. The pirate, who more often spoke with her sword than with her tongue, simply did not understand. Bellany shrugged and began casting her strongest spell, a fireball. As she finished, she aimed the blast not at the distant pursuing ship, which was long out of range and which, if it was Sea Sprite, would have had no trouble repelling such an attack anyway, but at the water behind Bloody Keel. The surf sizzled and sputtered in protest as the flames licked at it, bringing a thick steam up behind the fast-sailing ship. Sheila Cree smiled and nodded her approval. Her pilot, a heavy-set woman with a big dimpled face and a yellow smile, knew the waters around the western tip of the Spine of the World better than anyone alive. She could navigate there on the darkest of nights, using no more than the sound of the currents splashing over the reefs. Dudermont's ship wouldn't dare follow them through the dangerous waters ahead. Soon enough, Bloody Keel would sail out beyond the third jetty, around the rocky bend, and into open waters if she chose, or turn even closer inland to a series of reefs and rocks, a place Sheila and her companions had come to call home.
"He's no way to know 'twas us," the crewman said again.
Sheila Cree nodded and hoped the man was right. Believed he probably was, for while Sea Sprite, a three-masted schooner, had such a unique signature of sails, Bloody Keel appeared to be just another small, unremarkable caravel. Like any other wise pirate along the Sword Coast, though, Sheila Cree had no desire to tangle with Dudermont's legendary Sea Sprite, or his skilled and dangerous crew, whoever he thought she was. And she'd heard rumors that Dudermont was looking for her. Though why the famous pirate hunter might be singling her out, she could only guess. Reflexively, the powerful woman reached back over her shoulder to feel the mark she'd had branded upon herself, the symbol of her newfound power and ambition. As with all the women serving in Kree's new sea and land group, Sheila wore the mark of the mighty warhammer she'd purchased from a fool in Luskin, the mark of Aegis Fang. Was that, then, the source of Dudermont's sudden interest? Sheila Kree had learned a bit of the warhammer's history, had learned that its previous owner, a drunken brute named Wulfgar, was a known friend of Captain Dudermont. That was a connection, but the pirate woman couldn't be certain. Hadn't Wulfgar been tried in Luskin for attempting to murder Dudermont after all? Sheila Kree shrugged it all away a short while later, as Bloody Keel worked dangerously through the myriad of rocks and reefs to the secret, sheltered Golden Cove. Despite the expert piloting, Bloody Keel connected more than once on a jagged shelf, and by the time they entered the bay, the caravel was listing to port. No matter, though, for in this pirate cove, surrounded by towering walls of jagged rock, Sheila and her crew had the means to repair the ship. They took Bloody Keel into a large cave, the bottom of a system of tunnels and caverns that climbed through this westernmost point of the spine of the world. Natural tunnels, now smoky from torches lining the walls, and rocky caverns made comfortable by the plunder of what was fast becoming the most successful pirate band anywhere along the northern reaches of the Sword Coast. The small-framed, black-haired sorceress gave a sigh. She likely knew that, with her magic, she'd be doing most of the work on these latest repairs.
"Damn that, Dudermont!" Bellany remarked.
"Damn our own cowardice, you mean!"
one smelly sea-dog remarked as he walked by. Sheila Kree stepped in front of the grumbling man, sneered at him, and decked him with a right cross to the jaw.
"I didn't think he even saw us!"
the prone man protested, looking up at the red-haired pirate with an expression of sheer terror. If one of the female crew of Bloody Keel crossed Sheila, they'd likely get a beating. But if one of the men stepped too far over the vicious pirate's line, he'd likely find out how the ship got its name. Keel-hauling was one of Sheila Cree's favorite games, after all. Sheila Kree let the dog crawl away, her thoughts more focused on the latest appearance of Dudermont. She had to admit it was possible that Sea Sprite hadn't really even seen them, and likely, if Dudermont and his crew had spotted the distant sails of Bloody Keel, they didn't know the ship's true identity. But Sheila Kree would remain cautious where Captain Dudermont was concerned. If the captain and his skilled crew were indeed determined to find her, then let it be here, at Golden Cove, the rocky fortress Sheila Kree and her crew shared with a formidable clan of ogres.
The dagger struck him squarely and bounced harmlessly to the floor.
Drisdo Erden would never have fallen for such a feint,
Lalorinel, the bald-headed elf, grumbled in a high and melodic voice. His eyes, blue flecked with gold, shone with dangerous intensity from behind the black mask that Lalorinel always wore. With a snap of the wrist, the sword went back into its scabbard.
If he did, he would have been quick enough a foot to avoid the throw, or quick enough a hand to get a scimitar back down for a block.
The elf finished with a huff.
I am not Drisdo Erden,
the half-elf, Tunavec, said simply. He moved to the side of the roof and leaned heavily against a crenellation, trying to catch his breath.
Masavech enchanted you with magical haste to compensate,
the elf replied, retrieving the dagger and adjusting his sleeveless, light brown tunic. Tunavec snorted at his opponent.
You do not even know how Drisdo Erden fights, he reminded. Truly! Have you ever seen him in battle? Have you ever watched the movements, impossible movements, I say, that you so readily attribute to him?
If Lalorinel was impressed by the reasoning, it did not show.
The tales of his fighting style and prowess are common in the Northland.
Common, and likely exaggerated, Tunavec reminded.
Lalorinel's bald head was shaking before Tunavec finished the statement, for the elf had many times detailed the prowess of Drizzt to his half-elf sparring partner. "I pay you well for your participation in these training sessions," Lalorinel said. "You would do well to consider every word I have told you about Drizzt O'Urden to be the truth, and to emulate his fighting style to the best of your meager abilities." Tunavec, who was naked to the waist, toweled off his thin and muscular frame. He held the towel out to Lalorinel, who just looked at him with contempt, which was usual after such a failure. The elf walked past, right to the trap door that led down to the top floor of the tower. "Your enchantment of stone skin is likely used up," the elf said with obvious disgust. Alone on the roof, Tunavec gave a helpless chuckle and shook his head. He moved to retrieve his shirt, but noted a shimmering in the air before he ever got there. The half-elf paused, watching as old Moskovich, the wizard, materialized into view.
"Did you please him this day?"
the gray-bearded old man asked, in a voice that seemed pulled out of his tight throat. Moskovich's somewhat mocking smile, full of yellow teeth, showed that he already knew the answer.
"Lalorinel is obsessed with that one," Tunavec answered, "more so than I would ever have believed possible."
Moskovich merely shrugged, as if that hardly mattered.
"He has labored for me for more than 5 years, both to earn the use of my spells and to pay you well," the wizard reminded. "We searched for many months to even find you, one who seemed promising in being able to emulate the movements of this strange dark elf, Drizzt O'Urden."
"Why waste the time, then?" the frustrated half-elf retorted. "Why do you not accompany Lalorinel to find this wretched drow and be done with him once and for all? Far easier that would seem than this endless sparring." Moskovich chuckled, as if to tell Tunavec clearly that he was underestimating this rather unusual drow, whose exploits, as Lalorinel and Moskovich had uncovered them, were indeed remarkable.
"Drizzt is known to be the friend of a dwarf named Brunner Battlehammer," the wizard explained. "Do you know the name?"
Tunavec, putting on his gray shirt, looked to the old human and shook his head.
"King of Mithril Hall," Moskovich explained. "Or at least he was. I have little desire to turn a clan of wild dwarves against me, bane of all wizards, dwarves. Making an enemy of Brunner Battlehammer does not seem to me to be an opportunity for advancement of wealth or health. Beyond that, I have no grudge against this Drizzt O'Urden," Moskovich added. "Why would I seek to destroy him?" "Because Lalorinel is your friend." "Lalorinel," Moskovich echoed, again with that chuckle. "I am fond of him, I admit, and in trying to hold my responsibilities of friendship, I often try to convince him that his course is self-destructive folly and nothing more."
"He will hear none of that, I am sure," said Tunavec.
"None," agreed Moskovich. "A stubborn one is Lalorinel Telebrenequiet, if that is even his name," snorted Tunavec, who was in a rather foul mood, especially concerning his sparring partner. "I to you as you to me," he translated.
For indeed, Lalorinel's name was nothing more than a variation on a fairly common elvish saying.
"The philosophy of respect and friendship, is it not?" asked the old wizard.
"And of revenge,"
Tunavec replied grimly. Down on the tower's middle floor, alone in a small private room, Lalorinel pulled off the mask and slumped to sit on the bed, stewing in frustration and hatred for Drizzt O'Urden. "How many years will it take?" the elf asked, and finished with a small laugh while fiddling with an onyx ring. "Centuries? It does not matter." Lalorinel pulled off the ring and held it up before his glittering eyes. It had taken 2 years of hard work to earn this item from Moskovich. It was a magical ring, designed to hold enchantments. This one held four, the four spells Lalorinel believed it would take to kill Drizzt O'Urden. Of course,
The Lorinel knew that to use these spells in the manner planned would likely result in the deaths of both combatants. It did not matter. As long as Drizdo Erden died, the Lorinel could enter the netherworld contented. Part 1. Hints of Darkness. It is good to be home. It is good to hear the wind of Icewind Dale, to feel its invigorating bite like some reminder that I am alive. That seems such a self-evident thing, that we are alive. And yet, too often, I fear, we easily forget the importance of that simple fact. It is so easy to forget that you are truly alive, or at least to appreciate that you are truly alive, that every sunrise is yours to view, and every sunset is yours to enjoy. And all those hours in between, and all those hours after dusk, are yours to make of what you will. It is easy to miss the possibility that every person who crosses your path can become an event and a memory, good or bad, to fill in the hours with experience instead of tedium, to break the monotony of the passing moments. Those wasted moments, those hours of sameness, of routine, are the enemy, I say, are little stretches of death within the moments of life. Yet it is good to be home. In the wild land of Icewind Dale, where monsters roam aplenty and rogues threaten the roads at every turn, I am more alive and more content than in many years. For too long, I struggled with the legacy of my dark past. For too long, I struggled with the reality of my longevity, that I would likely die long after Brunner, Wolfgar, and Regis, and Catty Bree. What a fool I am to rue the end of her days without enjoying the days that she, that we, now have. What a fool I am to let the present slip into the past while lamenting a potential, and only potential, future. We are all dying, every moment that passes of every day. That is the inescapable truth of this existence. It is a truth that can paralyze us with fear, or one that can energize us with impatience, with a desire to explore and experience, with the hope, nay, the iron will, to find a memory in every action. To be alive under sunshine or under starlight, in weather fair or stormy. To dance every step, be they through gardens of bright flowers or through deep snows. The young know this truth so many of the old, or even middle-aged, have forgotten. Such is the source of the anger, the jealousy that so many exhibit toward the young. So many times have I heard the common lament, "If only I could go back to that age, knowing what I now know." Those words amuse me profoundly, for in truth, the lament should be, "If only I could reclaim the lust and the joy I knew then." That is the meaning of life, I have come at last to understand, and in that understanding, I have indeed found that lust and that joy. Life of 20 years where that lust and joy, where that truth is understood, might be more full than a life of centuries with head bowed and shoulders slumped. I remember my first battle beside Wolfgar, when I led him in against tremendous odds and mighty giants with a huge grin and a lust for life. How strange that as I gained more to lose, I allowed that lust to diminish. It took me this long, through some bitter losses, to recognize the folly of that reasoning. It took me this long, returned to Icewind Dale after unwittingly surrendering the crystal shard to Jarlaxle and completing at last, and forever, I pray, my relationship with Artemis and Treri, to wake up to the life that is mine, to appreciate the beauty around me, to seek out and not shy away from the excitement that is there to be lived. There remain worries and fears, of course. Wolfgar is gone from us, I know not where, and I fear for his head, his heart, and his body. But I have accepted that his path was his own to choose, and that he, for the sake of all three, head, heart, and body, had to step away from us. I pray that our paths will cross again, that he will find his way home. I pray that some news of him will come to us
either calming our fears or setting us into action to recover him. But I can be patient and convince myself of the best. For to brood upon my fears for him, I am defeating the entire purpose of my own life. That I will not do. There is too much beauty. There are too many monsters, and too many rogues. There is too much fun. Drizzt Do'Urden.
Chapter 1. Back to Back. His long white hair rolled down Catibree's shoulder, tickling the front of her bare arm, and her own thick auburn hair cascaded down Drizzt's arm and chest. The two sat back to back on the banks of Mare de Walden, the largest lake in Icewind Dale, staring up at the hazy summer sky. Lazy white clouds drifted slowly overhead, their white fluffy lines sometimes cut in sharp contrast as one of many huge skin-look vultures coasted underneath. It was the clouds, not the many birds that were out this day, that held the attention of the couple. "A knucklehead trout on the gaff?" Catibree said of one unusual cloud formation, a curving oblong before a trailing, thin line of white. "How do you see that?" the dark elf protested with a laugh. Catibree turned her head to regard her black-skinned, violet-eyed companion.
"How do ye not?" she asked. "It's as plain as the white line of your own eyebrows."
Drizzt laughed again, but not so much at what the woman was saying, but rather at how she was saying it. She was living with Brunner's clan again in the dwarven mines just outside of Ten Towns, and the mannerisms and accent of the rough-and-tumble dwarves were obviously again wearing off on her. Drizzt turned his head a bit toward the woman as well, his right eye barely a couple of inches from Catibree's. He saw the sparkle there. It was unmistakable. A look of contentment and happiness only now returning in the months since Wolfgar had left them. A look that seemed, in fact, even more intense than ever before. Drizzt laughed and looked back up at the sky.
"Your fish got away," he announced,
for the wind had blown the thin line away from the larger shape.
"It is a fish,"
Catibree insisted petulantly. Or at least, the woman made it sound as if she was being petulant. Smiling, Drizzt didn't pursue the argument.
"Ye darn fool, little one!"
Brunner Battlehammer grumbled and growled, spittle flying as his frustration increased. The dwarf stopped and stamped his hard boot ferociously on the ground, then smacked his one-horned helmet onto his head, his thick orange hair flying wildly from beneath the brim of the battered helm.
"I'm here thinking I got a friend on the council, and there ye go, letting Kempotargos go and spout the price without even a fight!"
Regis the halfling, thinner than he had been in years and favoring one arm from a ghastly wound he'd received on his last adventure with his friends, just shrugged and replied,
"Kempotargos speaks only of the price of the ore for the fishermen."
"And the fishermen buy a considerable portion of the ore!"
Brunner roared.
"Why'd I put ye back on the council, Rumblebelly, if ye ain't to be making me life any easier?"
Regis gave a little smile at the tirade. He thought to remind Brunner that the dwarf hadn't put him back on the council, that the folk of Lonelywood, needing a new representative since the last one had wound up in the belly of a yeti, had begged him to go, but he wisely kept the notion to himself.
"Fisherman!"
the dwarf said, and he spat on the ground in front of Regis's hairy, unshod feet. Again, the halfling merely smiled and sidestepped the mark. He knew Brunner was more bellow than bite, and knew, too, that the dwarf would let this matter drop soon enough, as soon as the next crisis rolled down the road. Ever had Brunner Battlehammer been an excitable one. The dwarf was still grumbling when the pair rounded a bend in the path to come in full view of Drizzt and Catibree, still sitting on the mossy bank, lost in their cloud dreams and just enjoying each other's company. Regis sucked in his breath, thinking Brunner might explode at the sight of his beloved adopted daughter in so intimate a position with Drizzt, or with anyone for that matter.
but Brunner just shook his hairy head and stormed off the other way.
"Darned fool elf,"
he was saying when Regis caught up to him.
"Will you just kiss the girl and be done with it?"
Regis's smile nearly took in his ears.
"How do you know that he has not?"
he remarked, for no better reason than to see the dwarf's cheeks turn as fiery red as his hair and beard. And, of course, Regis was quick to skitter far out of Brunner's deadly grasp. The dwarf just put his head down, muttering curses and stomping along. Regis could hardly believe that boots could make such a thunder on a soft, mossy dirt path. The clamor in Brynshander's council hall was less of a surprise to Regis. He tried, he really did, to stay attentive to the proceedings, as Elderman Cassius, the highest-ranking leader in all of Ten Towns, led the discussion through mostly procedural matters. Always before had the Ten Towns been ruled independently, or through a council comprised of one representative of each town. But so great had Cassius's service been to the region that he was no longer the representative of any single community, even that of Brynshander, the largest town by far, and Cassius's home. Of course, that didn't sit well with Kemp of Targos, leader of the second city of Ten Towns. He and Cassius had often been at odds, and with the elevation of Cassius and the appointment of a new counselor from Brynshander, Kemp felt outnumbered. But Cassius had continued to rise above it all, and over the last few months, even stubborn Kemp had grudgingly come to admit that the man was acting in a generally fair and impartial manner. To the counselor from Lonelywood, though, the level of peace and community within the council hall in Brynshander only added to the tedium. The halfling loved a good debate and a good argument, especially when he was not a principal, but could, rather, snipe in from the edges, fanning the emotions and the intensity. Alas for the good old days! Regis tried to stay awake, he really did, when the discussion became a matter of apportioning sections of the Mare de Walden deep waters to specific fishing vessels, to keep the lines untangled and keep the tempers out on the lake from flaring. That rhetoric had been going on in Ten Towns for decades, and Regis knew no rules would ever keep the boats apart out there on the cold waters of the large lake. Where the knucklehead were found, so the boats would go, whatever the rules. Knucklehead trout, perfect for scrimshaw and good eating besides, were the staple of the town's economy, the lure that brought so many ruffians to Ten Towns in search of fortune. The rules established in this room, so far from the banks of the three great lakes of Icewind Dale, were no more than tools councillors could use to bolster subsequent tirades when the rules had all been ignored. By the time the halfling councillor from Lonelywood woke up, the discussion had shifted, thankfully, to more concrete matters, one that concerned Regis directly. In fact, the halfling only realized a moment later the catalyst for opening his eyes had been Cassius's call to him.
"Pardon me for disturbing your sleep,"
the elder man of Ten Towns quietly said to Regis.
I have been, working many days and nights in preparation for, coming here,"
the halfling stammered, embarrassed.
"And Brynshander is a long walk."
Cassius, smiling, held his hand up to quiet Regis before the halfling embarrassed himself even more. Regis didn't need to make excuses to this group in any case. They understood his shortcomings and his value, a value that depended upon, to no small extent, the powerful friends he kept.
"Can you take care of this issue for us, then?"
Kemp of Targos, who among the councillors was the least enamored of Regis, asked gruffly.
"Issue?"
Regis asked. Kemp put his head down and cursed quietly.
"The issue of the highwayman," Cassius explained. "Since this newly sighted band is across the Sharingarn and south of Bremen, we know it would be a long ride for your friends. But we would certainly appreciate the effort if once again you and your companions could secure the roads into the region."
Regis sat back, crossed his hands over his still ample, if not as obviously as before, belly, and assumed a rather elevated expression. So that was it, he mused. Another opportunity for him and his friends to serve as heroes to the folk of Ten Towns. This was where Regis was fully in his element.
even though he had to admit he was usually only a minor player in the heroics of his more powerful friends. But in the council sessions, these were the moments when Regis could shine, when he could stand as tall as powerful Kemp. He considered the task Cassius had put to him. Bremen was the westernmost of the towns, across the Sharingarn River, which would be low now that it was late summer.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Sea of Swords, Book 3 in the Legend of Drizzt Paths of Darkness series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.